Hey, everybody, this is Kev O'Donoghue with Ben Starr, back with you with The Positive Mind, bringing you some ideas, concepts, and guests, try and help you lead a more positively minded life. And as promised, we have Harville Hendricks, Helen LaKelly Hunt, and Carol Kramer back in our studio, but Harville and Helen are for the first time. Welcome, all of you. Say hi.
Hi.
You're alive. Hi, we're glad to be here.
Welcome
Very
back.
Glad to be here.
Great to be back.
Listen,
great to
folks,
be here with Helen and Harville.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. Thank you for bringing this all together, Carol.
You're welcome.
I mean, listen, folks, if you are interested in love and loving, then you probably know the name of Harville Hendricks and Helen LaKelly Hunt. Because over 30 years ago now, almost 30 years ago, they wrote a book called Getting the Love You Want, in which they told us about how romantic love is only one step. Sorry to say this. It's only one step in the process of a love relationship. And that the secret, really, to a life of love and loving is, guess what? Get to know your partner. Get to know your partner. I know it's a drag. You think like, the secret to a life of love and loving is not getting your partner to give you what you need. That's what most people think love is. If I can only get my partner back to the way it was at the beginning, if I can only get that romance, the chemicals we had back at the beginning, then we'll be okay. But the truth is, the fact is, you cannot go back there. It will not happen. It's like an adult wanting the Christmas of childhood. It cannot happen. You can only go forward, and the way forward is to know your partner, the person you're living with. Do you know your partner? Do you know them intimately, in detail? You share meals with this person. You go to bed with this person. You have responsibilities with this person. Do you know them? Do you know what they need? Can you give to them? Do you want to give to them? The secret of a life of loving is to know your partner. Do you ever look at your partner and say, what do they need from me? Can you look at your partner silently and step back and say, what do they need? Well, the future of your love relationship and you're actually getting the love you want, again, the title of the book, Getting the Love You Want, starts by asking, what does he or she need from me? So we have an hour to talk about Harville Hendricks and Helen LaKelly Hunt's discoveries on how we learn to give partners what they need from us. Harville, I'm going to start off by asking you, why does the romantic stage of love end? I mean, does it have to?
Yes, has to.
Has to? I mean, there are people out there going out to dinners, parties, trying to keep the magic, renting limousines, doing everything to keep the spark alive. And it's going to die anyway, right?
It's going to die anyway. It's the first step in all love relationships is romantic attachment. And romantic attachment is fundamentally powered by an illusion about who the person is that you're connected to and that you've selected, unconsciously selected as your partner. And to that person is attached expectations because the person is connected to unconscious memories from your relationship with your caretakers in childhood. So there are expectations attached to this person that you fell in love with that are similar to the expectations you had justifiably with your caretakers, but which didn't get met.
And that's a lot going on. I mean,
it's a lot going on.
People really believe that. I mean, people go to parties and see somebody at a party and you're saying, you know, I'm already expecting from that person.
Yep.
Already. I mean, this is how fast the mind works, right? I mean, how fast the unconscious is ready to just jump in there.
Right. As soon as you see them across the crowded room and you go to them like a moth to the flame, you do not go with them with open hands and arms to give. You go with them with unconscious expectations that this person is going to satisfy need. This is all unconscious. You don't know this is going on.
Right.
This just powers the emotions of attraction that this person is going to meet a need that didn't get met in childhood. And that need is not negotiable to the unconscious mind, because in childhood it was connected to survival. You had to have the caretaker respond in a certain way. And when the caretaker, and usually it was very simple, it was reliable warmth and presence and response to distress and lowering your distress when you had it, whether it was for hunger, cold, or sleep, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And if you have a caretaker who is attuned to the child, then those needs get met, and they don't then travel with you to adulthood. But if they don't get met, they travel with you to adulthood, although the part of your mind is not adult. Your part of your mind lives in a timeless area, timeless space. So what was not finished in childhood still remains unfinished in the unconscious mind, although you grow up into becoming a large person with a large body and what we would call an adult. So the emotion attached to that unconscious perception is intense, but that's fed by expectation that I'm going to get what I didn't get, and it's not complicated. It's like I'm going to get a reliable response. I'm going to get a present person. I'm going to get a smile. I'm going to get a person to pay attention, and primarily it's being present to me.
Yeah.
And so you fall in love and you have this expectation. Now keep in mind, two people are doing this, so it's a double expectation.
Right.
I expect it of you, you expect it of me. Neither one of us is saying anything about that expectation. We're just waiting for you to respond without having to be asked, because you're supposed to know what it is. And you don't. So then that's a disappointment. And now the expectation increases, because when a need is not met, the expectation of that satisfaction increases, because the need is not negotiable. So now I'll start saying, well, you didn't, or when are you? You didn't come home early last night. You didn't call me. We haven't made love in a while. So you increase, when your expectations are not fed, then you increase your frustration, mm-hmm. expressions about that. And then that moves not only to frustration but to criticism. And after a while, this person who was your dream becomes your nightmare, i.e. they now have become the unresponsive parents in your unconscious mind. And now you're fussing at them to try to get them to become responsible to the expectations that you have. And, of course, they can't, because they have their own limitations for their childhood. So that leads to what we call the power struggle. So romantic love ends. But even when you go to the power struggle, you're still trying to get the need met. You just now turn to coercion and criticism and negation to try to get them to shape up, which, of course, makes them offer you even less.
So two things. First of all, is people think that they're falling in love with that person. I'm falling in love with, she's a good dancer. She listens to me. She does this. And what you're falling in love with is a need fulfillment, right? I mean, the idea that I'm going to get my needs met here.
Right. You're falling in love with a fantasy person, a person you make up in your mind and project onto the actual body and personality that you are falling in love with. And so it's the fantasy that this person doesn't match that makes you want to try to get this person to become the fantasy person so the need can get met. So as you were saying earlier about getting to know your partner, who you live with, that's the agenda of a satisfying marriage, is that you have to discover that you have to discover something of all of this, but ultimately you just have to discover this is who you really are, and then you love who the person really is rather than the person you wish they would be.
That's quite a shift.
It's a tectonic shift.
It's a tectonic shift.
Yeah, and it's why 50% of the people don't make that shift. So they get divorces.
It's really that much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's been that much since 19. Actually, we can date the rise of divorce in America was after the Second World War. And it started moving in 1955. It was high. And partly because of the returning soldiers whose expectations was that they would retake their role in the family.
Right.
But their wives had taken those roles in the family, and so when The wives could very well run the tractor or the company or whatever.
They had a taste of that.
So the guy comes back and says, I want the seat on the tractor again. And she says, well, actually, we don't. I can run the tractor, and I like to run the tractor. Why don't you take care of the kids or do something else?
Right.
So the divorce rate began to happen as a result of that collision of role expectation. And started moving up to, by 1972, it was about 50%. And it's been over and under that line now ever since 1972.
Is that international, or is it mostly the Western?
It's in everywhere Western civilization has penetrated. Right, in fact, right now in Korea, where we have a huge community of Imago therapists, the divorce rate is 70%. And at 70%, as the community, as Korea began to move toward a democracy, meaning integrating Western values into their traditional culture, their marriages were traditional. They were usually arranged. They were very stable because they responded to all the expectations of Korean tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And when those traditions began to be altered by the infusion of Western democratic values and Western cultural values, the divorce rate, because you're freed now from this marriage that you didn't choose anyway, and which you've been living in because it was a cultural expectation,
right?
But that's no longer there.
Yeah.
So now marriage is supposed to meet my needs, not just be a cultural form. And our friend over there, his name is Jay, says Imago has to come to Korea because we have a 70% divorce rate. We have to do something about this, and he's done something about it. He's got, what is it, 46 counseling centers. The head of
in
all
Korea?
Of them
very
are Imago therapists
in Korea.
In Korea,
wow.
As a network.
Wow. Do we have that many here in the States?
I think he has more centers for therapy headed by Imago therapists than we have here. We have about, 1,200 people who are practicing.
That's got to change.
In their practices.
Because we're a much bigger country than South Korea.
We're a much bigger country, and we should have clinics and centers and all of that.
And divorce is probably going up. I mean, I don't know. There's a revolution happening in marriage.
Well, actually, the divorce rate has declined a bit in the past decade. I mean, by that, I mean under 50%, like about 45 to 47%. But what we think is happening there, the people who do this kind of research, is the marriage rate is also lower because we've shifted from marriage to cohabitation.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The cohabitation rate has risen so high that it's now higher than the marriage rate in America. So if you look at those numbers as a numbers guy, you see that the decline in divorce is related to the decline in marriage, not to the increase in the satisfaction of marriages married couples.
And also people are marrying later. So there's a
theory
that
people are marrying nearly 5 to 7 years later. Yeah.
So I want the audience to get this concept, because the reason people get divorced is because they're hanging on to the concept of attachment, the idea of a romantic love, and that's what love is supposed to be. And they're unwilling to make the shift to look at my partner and say, okay, what do they need? And it's as simple as that.
Yeah,
it's as simple as that.
Right. It's as simple as that. And people, by the time they get the highest divorce rate is in the seventh year.
Yeah,
and the second highest divorce rate now is the year after retirement at 55 or 65. Those divorce rates are paralleling each other. And but the divorces by the seventh year. I have now experienced so much pain with you that it's no longer much about my childhood. It's turned out you are a real jerk. And therefore, but the unconscious is saying it's not here, have to find it somewhere else. But it's not giving up the need.
I got you. Go ahead, Ellen.
Also, the reason people get divorced is they think that initial attraction is what it'll be like to be with that partner.
Right.
So, wow, you know, they found someone who was, like, there's something inside. It's just perfect. There's something amazing. It's a perfect match.
Mm.
And, I'm going to be able to love this person, and they're going to just adore me forever. And they don't know that that is stage one. And after stage one, there is stage two that every single couple goes through, and it's disillusionment.
Okay.
It's like it always shifts from the illusion to the disillusionment. And then they go, oh, wait, my partner tricked me. They're sort of a jerk. And like, they just pretended they were so da-da-da. And they don't know that every relationship that's a romantic one mm-hmm. has a natural stage, which is stage two. And there's all sorts of stuff you can do in stage two. Imago therapy is all about understanding why that couple moves from stage one to two and how to get to stage three, which is real love.
If you're just joining us, you tune into The Positive Mind here on 99.5 FM WBAI. I'm Ben Starr here with Kevin O'Donohue. Our guests today, Harville Hendricks, Helen LaKelly-Hunt, and Carol Kramer rejoins us. Carol was here in January discussing Imago therapy. Thank you all for being here. It's fascinating stuff. And I think that it's universal because I think that we've all been in a situation at the beginning of a relationship where the little bit of doubt begins to creep in. And it kind of makes us question the entire situation. It makes us question our own judgment. It makes us question our partners. And I'm wondering, what when you talk about step two, Helen, within the context of that relationship, where does that take us?
Well, I'd like to tell Kevin how brilliant I think he has been to say the question we should be asking is, what does my partner need from me? Because you go into stage two, and people are mad. Right. I don't usually use cuss words, but, I mean, they're pissed because their partner seems so great at the beginning. And, like, they're sloppy, they're lazy. Right. Like, what's wrong? So, and they don't ask the question, what does my partner need from me? But can I tell you, Kevin, an example of someone who did that completely wrong?
Sure.
They didn't ask that question?
Yeah.
It's me. I'll tell you what I did in stage two. Like, the big thing, I thought I knew what Harville needed. In fact, I thought I knew what Harville needed more than Harville thought what he needed. Because, like, I'm good at analysis of other people, and I can do strategic thinking on how they can get better. So I was forever devoted to learning how I could improve Harville. And I felt like if anyone wants to know how Harville's feeling any day, you could really ask me. I know him like a book. And I'm going to help him become the person I'm sure he wants to be. Well, we were at the divorce court with me being that way. Like, that's eradicating to someone if you say you know them. If anyone is listening and you think you know who your partner is, you probably don't. And what I needed to learn to do was ask questions.
Yeah.
And ask my partner more things about who we need to ask. One day I started asking Harville questions about what is it he needed from me. And then he began to open up, trust me. And, oh, I learned so much.
Say more.
About what I was doing wrong and what he really needed from me.
Harville, do you remember that day?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Once he started talking, he talked the whole weekend. And I learned things about Harville I had never known, and that we had lived together 20 years. I had no idea his inner world. And they are not going to share that with you unless you ask them to tell you.
Right. Right. Yep. And would you have, I mean, we're going to get to Carol in a second, but would you have told her what you need somewhere along the line? I mean, did it have to come from her?
Well, that depends on the kind of personality you are.
Right.
So I'm an introvert, and introverts don't say what they need.
Yeah.
Extroverts say what they need.
And most men don't say what they need.
Well, I would say some men don't.
Okay.
I think that we can overcharacterize men as in a certain way.
All right. Well, you have more experience than I do, for sure.
The fact is that some men are extroverts, and so they are expressive of their needs, and they
Okay.
And they marry introverts who are not expressors of them when it's a male-female marriage. And if it's in a gay marriage, there's still a polarity that people marry complementary people. So I am – it's not my nature, i.e. my character, my personality, to go up and say what I want. It's my personality to not get it and to be withdrawn and be mad about it.
Yeah.
So Helen asked me, and then I don't talk because I'm scared, because introverts are introverts because they're afraid to express themselves because they expressed themselves at some point in their lives when they were little and didn't work. Yeah. So you learn the best thing to do is just keep your mouth shut and wait. And wait.
Until
and
35.
It doesn't come. And then after a while, you're pissed and you don't even want it.
And
then.
I hadn't learned to make it safe so that you could talk.
Yep.
Which is why safety has become the theme of how a couple needs to treat each other so that it can become safe for them to talk.
Sure.
Or else they will never understand, quote, what does my partner need from me?
Yeah. Yep. Carol?
So as a mago therapist, I focus on what does the relationship need. And so I have each partner, when they first come in for the first session, look at what the relationship would look like if it was exactly the way they wanted it to be. And they each make a list of 3 to 5 points that would really satisfy their dreams of what a great relationship would look like.
So we'd go dancing once a month.
We have lots of fun. We make mad, passionate love.
Okay.
We are best friends. And then I ask them after each of them lists what they would like, what would you need to do in order to help that to happen in your relationship? So it no longer becomes what my partner would have to do. It's how I would need to stretch and how I would need to show up so that my partner would want to make love to me, so that my partner wouldn't be critical of me because I wouldn't be critical of him. And so in order to make it safe for your partner, for yourself, you have to make it safe for your partner by not being critical.
Sure.
Because we look at criticism as being self-abusive.
Right. And you have to prioritize. You have to say, well, if I want to do that, I need to save money in order to be able to do that, to have that happen in my relationship, right? I mean, it gets people thinking in a way that if this is really what I need to do when we want to do, we have to make that happen. If that means cutting out this and adding this.
Right. And one of the things that's so different than an imago session, I've been told by couples who come often to an imago therapist as their last effort to save their marriage, is that it no longer becomes a griping session about my partner does this, my partner does that. There's no space for that in an imago session. It's all about showing what you appreciate, showing what is working, and showing what you would need to do to make it even better. And the dialogue process is really what makes that happen, because as Harville was saying, is that we want something from our partner that we didn't get often from our caretakers. And that's to be heard, and that's to be understood, and that's to feel this connection. And so just even in the position of the dialogue process, where couples are sitting face to face, eyeball to eyeball, knee to knee, they are making this very special contact that they never have made. Some of them never have looked at each other for the amount of time a session.
Yes.
And they're just blown away
by,
wow, we actually heard each other and you didn't interrupt me.
Right.
You listened to everything I had to say and remembered it. Because the dialogue process really encourages you to, I say, sit on your world and cross over into your partner's world so that you can really see them and hear them.
So I want to say, Helen, you'll jump in a sec, but I want to say this is the positive.
That's what I was
right?
going to say.
This,
I was just
this
gonna
is
say
the positive
the
mind.
Positive mind.
But, right. So, but this is the positive of frustration in your relationships, this disillusionment in your relationships. You're not being critical of your partner. You're actually getting to say what it is you need and the possibility of making it happen. It couldn't happen with mom and dad all those years of not being responded to, but it can happen with your partner. And it's magical what you feel when it is met, when you're getting needs that you didn't even know you had, you weren't even able to put into words, and now in front of your mature adult partner, you're able to say what I need. Okay. jump in there, Helen.
No. I just have two sentences.
Oh. Go ahead.
Is this good? Okay. Yes, Kevin, and that's just what I was thinking. The name of this show is The Positive Mind.
Right.
And what Carol has just outlined helps that couple shift from the lower brain, where they're angry and mad, and she, in Imago Therapy, people are moved immediately to the upper brain, where they wonder about what does their dream marriage look like, and imagine if it was their dream marriage. Wow. And she has moved them into another part right. of her brain, the positive mind, and then what can I do to make that happen? So we really shift people out of the lower into the upper brain in the very first session.
Talk a little bit about zero negativity.
Well, let me make one comment to off-ramp from this, is that what Helen and Carol are both talking about is something that we've discovered, I think began to focus on only in the past probably decade or less than that, is curiosity. And you would think that, not a sexy thing. Curiosity is very sexy because it replaces judgment. So when you want to get to know your partner, instead of going to judgment about, you never ask me questions and blah, 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 it's all centered on yourself, that if you shift out of yourself, you go to the prefrontal cortex, mm-hmm. to the positive mind, in order to engage the prefrontal cortex of your partner, which means then you're regulating the amygdala, which is the emotional mind,
right.
rather than coming from the emotional mind and the amygdala, you're coming from the prefrontal cortex. So now you can actually regulate your feelings and regulate them down so that you can actually connect.
Got it.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
So what we really push is the way to shift into this second stage is that you go to curiosity so that you actually get to know your partner. And when you go there, you create enough safety through interest that your partner will actually begin to disclose him or herself. And then when they do that, you have to hold that rather than say, oh, that's not what I was looking for. Sorry. And then criticize it because then the curiosity becomes judgment. But you have to stay into curiosity and go to acceptance. And it's a nuance.
Sure.
But the nuance transforms the room into safety instead of danger. And now all the good things can happen.
So the minimizer, as Harold was saying, who was too inhibited perhaps as a child because of various reasons, now all of a sudden starts to find his or her voice because his partner or her partner starts to show this interest and makes it safe for them to find their voice.
Yeah.
That's a big do you get curious about yourself first? I mean, would you say, I'm having this kind of reaction?
Well, we operate out of a different paradigm.
Go ahead.
The primary paradigm of psychotherapy in the Western world is self. That I go to me, I go inside, I explore myself, I get to know myself.
Right.
And what we have discovered is you actually can't do that because you will only go into your memories and into your fantasies, and you will know what they are. But what really, you are who you are when you are interacting with your partner. That's who you really are. It's what you do. It's like that song we started off with, love is how you treat each other when the day is done. So the curiosity that gets you into your prefrontal cortex is about another person, not about the self. That's self-investment. The other is other investment.
Okay.
And when you do that, what you then is create a safe space in which the energy begins to flow between two people because of the safety. Mm-hmm. That relaxes the defenses. And now I can become vulnerable. And it's that point that two real people begin to engage each other beyond their defenses.
Our guests today, Harville Hendricks, Harold McKelley-Hunt, and Carol Kramer, you are tuned into The Positive Mind. We're going to take a short musical break, and we'll be back after this. Stay tuned.
to be humble, to be kind. It is a giving of the peace in your mind to a stranger, to a friend. To give in such a way that has no end. We are love. We are one. We are how we treat each other when the day is done. We are peace. We are war. We are how we treat each other and nothing more. And to be bold, to be brave, it is the thinking that the heart can still be saved. And the darkness can come quick. The danger's in the anger and in the hanging on to it. We are love. We are one. We are how we treat each other when the day is done. We are peace. We are war. We are how we treat each other. Tell me what it is that you see. A world that's full of endless possibilities. And heroes don't look like they used to. They look like you do.
Sounds of the Alternate Roots here on 99.5 FM WBAI. I'm Ben Starr here with Kevin O'Donohue and our guests today, Harville Hendricks, Halila Kelly Hunt, Carol Kramer, all here to talk about the Imago Therapy, and we're going to talk about what exactly that means. How would you define Imago? What does that mean to you?
Well, there's a little story I'd like to tell about that, which is when in 1980, we began constructing this system called Imago. We got to the point in the first training program in Dallas. It was in Dallas at the time of saying, well, what are we going to call this? Right. And so we spent with the trainees who were sitting around, we spent a lot of time talking about, well, how do you name this? Because if we don't name it, somebody's going to claim it. So we have to name it and do a, you know, then do a copyright trademark and copyrights and all that sort of stuff. So the story is that the selection process is having an image in your mind that's unconscious, that was created by the interactions with your caretakers when in childhood. And this is the template through which you then screen in and screen out everyone that will with whom you'll fall in love. And they, mm-hmm. the one you fall in love is the one who most matches the most negative traits in your caretakers, which is kind of strange. But what we finally discovered that's connected to the deepest need comes from the caretaker with whom you had the worst experience. So the brain is more tied in then to this is a really critical mm-hmm. thing. So we said, well, let's call it image therapy. And we sat around and talked about it and said, image therapy, that sounds so vapid and right. plain vanilla and so forth. And so I went home that night and looked up the word image because we talked about the unconscious image. And it means, in Latin, it's imago. And since I studied Latin in high school, I said, I think I can claim one Latin word for this system. So we called it imago. And basically that's what it means. Imago is the unconscious template in the mind created in the interaction with your caretakers in childhood that sets up your predisposition to look for somebody in adulthood who is similar to the caretakers that you had in childhood.
Right. And I just want to say out to the audience, you know you do this, folks. We know that we do this. We scan the environment for people that are safe and not safe for us. And similarly, we scan the environment, whether we know it or not. We scan the environment for people that are going to meet our needs and who isn't going to meet our needs. And we do it so quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, there should be a science on how quickly we keep people away from us who we know are in some way a threat. And how we try to attract people who we know right away is going to meet our, you know, meet our needs or whatever you want to call it.
Or frustrate our needs.
Or frustrate.
It's really about frustrate.
I'm so good at picking people who frustrate me.
And that science is called gut instinct. There's a third mind that's down here, like upper brain, lower brain, and the gut.
When I met my late husband, he was sitting across the room from me, and I had no idea about anything about him. I just had this sense that if I ever marry again, this is going to be my next husband.
Is that right?
It was just very uncanny. Yeah.
And you had a wonderful relationship for
years.
So sometimes it works in your favor. The frustration can really, really blossom into a beautiful, beautiful relationship.
Well, when you learn how to take your frustration and make them into requests rather than criticism, that's the work.
I want you to walk us through a little bit about doing that, turning requests or turning frustrations into requests. But I wanted before, since it's early at the second half of the show, this disillusionment that happens, because we're about to go into the mature aspect, but this disillusionment happens. I read in one of your introductions, Harville, that you were watching your first wife or somebody who was in a distance from you and you saw how she moved.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, it dawned on you, I'm not going to get what I need.
Yep.
And, sometimes after the romance, you're out to dinner with your partner and you all of a sudden don't like the way they hold their fork.
Yep.
And it really becomes catastrophic. You say, oh, how could I be with this? This is embarrassing. I don't really want – how are they ever going to really follow through for years on end to give me what I want?
Mm-hmm.
So the whole world really does come crashing down.
Yep.
In that moment. You want to talk a little bit about that experience?
It can come down, and like you're saying, without anything dramatic happening. It's a shift, and I remember that very well, that it was on our honeymoon with my first wife.
Gosh.
That we were on a beach, and she was walking ahead of me, and there was a droop in her shoulder. And my brain suddenly brought up, and I did not know this at the time, my mother, who was not depressed but was preoccupied because she had 11 children on a one-horse farm in South Georgia.
Wow.
So she was clearly not emotionally available,
and
she was tired, and her shoulders drooped from that.
Sure.
And when my ex-wife's walking down, shoulders drooped, I had this, I don't know what it was a shock of recognition. And I told myself at that time, although the marriage lasted 16 years, nothing ever overcame that negative expectation, which fulfilled itself.
Mm-hmm.
Because her unavailability, like my tired mother, I couldn't change that.
You didn't know any way to get beyond that.
And all the therapies that existed at that time did not have what we now know about what you have to do to move out of that into a connection with a real person. They were therapies that were based on conflict resolution, negotiation, problem solving, but not at all on understanding that projective experience from childhood that runs your marriage.
What Harville didn't realize is that's why he picked his first wife, because her shoulders drooped, because it reminded him of his mother.
He must have seen that before. Yep. He just didn't know it.
And I love the way Carol has talked about imago is user-friendly. And so we can talk about our caretakers. We're going to be attracted to someone who's like our caretakers, and they're either going to be intrusive or neglectful. Like, we can generalize one or the other.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Then you can invite anyone to sit, and if they are going to identify their childhood wound or the childhood issue they were drawn to, they can just pick one, you know. And and most people had both in their caretaking, but what was the most painful? And once you get that identified, you can share that with your partner, and your partner can do the same thing and share it with you.
Right.
And you begin to learn to care for each other and grow in a way that your partner needs. Give them what they need.
Exactly.
Yeah, so one of the questions that we talked about earlier was about curiosity, is to be curious about how did I hurt you? It's not just what you need, but when something happens in the power struggle or when couples have any kind of a rupture, it's really being curious about what is it that I've done or how did you perceive me or experience me? And so in the dialogue process that Harville and Helen so brilliantly included, the question is there more about that? So after the person is speaking and the person, their partner is listening, they then have the question, can you tell me more about that, or is there more about that? And that's one of the things that really also shocks the person who's speaking, is that, my goodness, not only is my partner listening, but they really want to know what I'm thinking and what I'm feeling, and they don't want me to just stop.
Right.
They don't just say enough about that. Yeah. And so I even have couples not use the word, is there any more about that, because I want it to really be an invitation.
Right.
And so that is such an invitation to really explore what is the more. And so that's what creates the real connection. Like, yeah, my goodness,
right,
someone is really loving me enough to want to know what's inside of me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the natural progression in a session of disclosure is, okay, at the end of this sentence, my partner's going to shift to themselves and say, well,
yes, right, they'll get a chance.
Are you done yet? Can I now talk?
Right.
But when you don't satisfy that expectation and say, well, is there more about that?
Yeah.
That really sends a message to the brain.
Right.
And that sends a message to the emotional brain that this person is present.
Yes.
And what we're learning, I think, and I think we could say with some definitiveness, is being present to another person is what is the healing process. It's not anything magical.
It's no major big insights.
No major big behavior.
Right.
I'm present to you, you're present to me. That's all I really need, because that's what I lost in childhood.
And that's where the safety comes.
We talk about a win-win situation, so that by being present for your partner, to your partner, you're healing by being present and giving them what they didn't get. And at the same time, you're winning because you're growing. You're growing a part of yourself that you needed, and that's to be able to be present to someone other, that you're in relationship. I love this expression that Harville often uses, that couples don't realize that they're in relationship with an other. And so by by acknowledging
not my projection or whatever, everything I need, I'm in a relationship with somebody.
somebody has different needs, different feelings, different thoughts.
Boy.
Yeah, and when you follow through with what Carol was saying, you get what you give.
Right.
We've also learned that, and that whatever you put out, by the very fact of putting it out, you get it, because your brain, there's a part of your brain, doesn't know you're giving it. It thinks you're giving it to it.
Right.
And that's the lower brain.
Right.
So you get whatever you get out. And then your partner responds in a positive way back, so you get a double whammy.
Yeah, so I always knew that in order for me to be safe, Steve and I took a relationship workshop with Harville and Helen in the 1990s. That's when I first discovered Imago. And I learned in that workshop that in order for me to be safe with Steve, I had to make it safe for him. So it wasn't about making it safe for
and
me.
And basically, I have to say, as an observer and witnessing Imago sessions, that this question, is there more about that, really changes both the listener and the receiver. I mean, you know, the sender and the receiver. I see actually physical softness happen to the people. So I think it echoes back to Harville's, that it's just being present that does the healing. Asking this question, is there more about that? That's just such a rare question to ask somebody.
And I just want to clarify, and I think Harville and Carol would agree, your profound question at the beginning, what does my partner need from me?
Yeah.
They need each other's presence.
Mm-hmm. That's the answer.
They just need their partner to when they're feeling a certain way, be present for them, not to have answers,
right?
Not to tell them what to do, which I used to be so good at for Harville, poor Harville.
Yeah.
But just to be present.
Well, you made me what I am today.
Be present, to be a witness to his experiencing of things. Yeah. And that's what the dialogue process is. And as you say, Kevin, the is there more helps us.
It's such a warm. In this busy, 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 busy world, busy culture, who is stopping to say, do you have more you want to share about that? I mean, how are we stopping to be present with each other? This paradigm, this therapy, this way of couples talking to each other just gets people to be present. Even in spite of yourself, you can't help yourself but become present.
Well, I often say to couples when I see the person who's listening becoming reactive, you can just see it physically happening, the tensing up, is to just breathe and meditate. It's like a meditation on your partner's words. Just take in their words and know that this is their reality. Just take it in and accept that this is their reality. You may not like it, but that's what it is. And in order to know your partner, you need to hear that.
Yeah, and when you're present, fully present, then you do something really amazing. You can move to empathy.
Go ahead.
Once you really see your partner for who they are, you're present to their experiencing, then you move to, oh my God, what it must be like for you to be you living in your world. And that means I'm not being present doesn't mean I now move to judgment. It means I move to empathy. And now we're beginning to actually change the structure of the brain because you've done prefrontal cortex work, emotional work, lower brain work. You go back and forth between those three lobes in the brain. It becomes more integrated, and as your brain becomes more integrated, you become less reactive. So you're more able then to deal with the outside without judging it because you're now actually seeing it rather than seeing the distortion of your fantasy.
Carol, how does empathy come into the dialogue?
Well, there are three steps in the dialogue process. The first step is mirroring, where you reflect back what your partner has said. The second step
is... So, for instance,
you just said to me, what I heard you say, Kevin, is how does empathy come into the dialogue process? So that's an example of mirroring.
Perfect.
And the second step is, well, it makes sense that you would want to know that. That's called validation. So I don't have to agree with what you're saying or your thoughts or feelings, but in order for me to validate what you're saying, I need to be able to see your truth, to understand what your point of view is. And the empathy is the third part, and that's your feelings. So based on all of that, I can imagine what you feel.
Right. So slow it down. First of all, you do a bunch of mirroring, right?
Yes.
You're bringing an issue. Can I have a dialogue with you about raising our kids,
mm-hmm.
right? And then you say, yes, okay, well, let's do it in 20 minutes. Okay, we'll do it then. Then you go in and you say, I'm having a problem with the way you neglect our kids or whatever. And so you would repeat back to me what?
So you're having a problem with the way I raise our kids.
Right.
And I neglect our kids. Did I get you? So I check with you to find out if I'm really hearing you accurately.
But first you're going to say, is there more to say about
it? No, first I want to know, unless you shake your head and let me know that I'm tracking what you're saying,
okay.
I will have to check with you. Am I getting what you're saying?
Yes.
So if I'm getting what you're saying, then I ask you, is there more about that? Can you tell me more about that?
Yes. You come home from work and you go into your room and you stay by yourself and I've been with the kids all day.
So...
Carol is putting her hand up, slowing me down.
So this means I want to slow you down so that I can remember what you're saying. This is a pause button.
Okay.
So I go into my room, and I don't ask you about how your day was. Did I get you?
No.
So what did I miss?
So I said that when you come home from work, you go into your room, you spend time by yourself, your kids don't see you.
So I go into my room, and I spend time by myself, and my kids don't see me. Did I get you now?
Yes, you got me.
Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, and so, okay, so this can go on for, what, 10 minutes?
It could go
until
on for 10 minutes, and then I give a summary of it, and then I say, well, it makes sense. What you're saying makes sense because I have been going into my room, and I'm not asking you about your day. And I can imagine, and I come up with feelings, I can imagine based on hearing you.
No. So you finish the validation process.
I finished the validation. I'm asking you, do I understand you? Am I understanding you?
Okay.
And yeah.
And now you're going to go into
And so let me say, I can imagine that you're feeling really neglected and annoyed and frustrated. Is that what you're feeling?
Yes.
And then I ask you, are there more feelings?
Yes.
And then you tell me the more feelings, and then I mirror that.
I miss my wife or my husband or whatever.
You miss your, yes.
I miss my, you know, my romantic partner. Where
so
are you?
You're missing me. Yes. You're missing me. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So it does soften, even just this
But,
fake,
but the important part is that, also the important part is then we switch, and you get a chance to say something about what's on your mind. The person who is listening gets a chance to speak as well, because that makes it a dialogue and not a monologue.
Right. And if it doesn't go both ways, then it is a one. We call it a one-way sin, which is actually a monologue.
Yeah.
But a dialogue is a two-way sin, because there are always two realities.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that I'd like to add to this is that we also help couples what we would call upgrade that conversation, by coming to you with a frustration turned into a request. So instead of saying, I want to talk to you about how you're neglecting the kids, I would come and say, can we have a conversation? And yes, about the kids.
Right.
So I will say to you then, well, I have a wish that I'd like to express about the kids, which is that, are you available for the wish?
Yes.
So when you come home from work, would you be willing to spend some time, first of all, with me, maybe 3 to 5 minutes, and then would you go find the kids and spend 5 or 10 minutes with them, and then blah, 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 blah.
Got it.
So I go, I bypass the frustration process, which will trigger your amygdala and your defenses, and I go straight to the wish, which triggers your prefrontal cortex.
Mm.
So now I'm responding out of my rational mind rather than my emotional mind, which I might have regulated in my other response, but I had to regulate it.
Right.
So this is what we would call advanced work, that you help people move from expressing a frustration to expressing the wish behind the frustration.
Right.
I just want to add that one of the aspects of Imago therapy that makes it, as Helen was quoting what I said, user-friendly, is that as an Imago therapist, you try to help your couples not need you, that we want to, them to use the dialogue outside of the Imago session.
Absolutely.
So that when things come up at home, they don't have to wait to the next week or 2 weeks later in order to have the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And they learn this technique that becomes part of their life and part of the whole flow of rupture, repair, and connection. And that's what we're looking for. There's often going to be ruptures, but it's how soon a couple can repair it. And the dialogue process really gives them that tool that they can use without a therapist.
Right. And it's not fair for only one person to go. You know, the thing is about Imago is that it's not threatening. If a partner comes to you and says, I have a problem, I want to work on this, I want to do a dialogue, you're also going to get a chance to do the dialogue and send your material.
Yes.
So it's not like a traditional gripe session where a partner is coming to you and complaining about a particular thing. It's a session where you're both going to be present and you're both going to get a turn to talk about something that you're feeling that you weren't even sure, you know, you didn't even know you were feeling.
And you're also checking to see whether your partner's available. You're not just springing your feelings on them when they come in the door, you know, I want to tell you about neglecting the kids. You give them the space, and this is also what creates the safety, by saying, are you available to have a conversation or a dialogue with me?
Okay. Listen, we have 3 minutes. There's lots to talk about. For instance, I wanted to talk about exits. How partners, this is like the invisible divorce.
Yeah.
Now, the 30-year anniversary of the book is coming out, Getting the Love You Want.
Yes. We are re-updating and revising Getting the Love You Want in its 30th year.
Yeah.
And it'll come out, and the new version will come out in early January.
Okay. And so in that is the Imago dialogue, what we're talking about here. And there's got to be around 20, 25 exercises in there. So one would be this frustration, turning her frustration into a request. But one of the things in the book that I found fascinating is this thing called an invisible divorce. People are walking around in their relationships really divorced for all intents and purposes.
Yes.
Tell, you know, a minute, how are people exiting their relationships and staying in the relationship?
Well, an exit is any behavior you engage in that takes energy away from the relationship. That could be social media. It could be an affair. It could be staying in your golf game an extra the nine holes instead of coming home with the first nine.
Okay.
Anything that facilitates your avoidance of your partner. And the avoidance is always rooted in the fact that you're frustrated. You have a need frustration that's going on. So you go somewhere else to either compensate for that or substitute for it. And so you can live in that space of avoidance for a long time without divorcing. Divorce may be one,
sure,
because divorce is the final terminal exit.
Right.
But you can do a lot of exiting that's meaning I'm not engaged and we're not interactive very much.
Right. And so you have to have that dialogue also.
You have
to come clean.
Also.
You have to say, I haven't made eye contact with you in a year and a half.
Yep.
And that's an exit.
Yep.
Right?
Oh, and by the way, and at workshops, it's so amazing because we require that at the beginning of the first exercise.
Right.
Actually, the first 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Couples have to look in each other's eyes, and they come up and say later, we haven't looked at each other's eyes for.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
I didn't know your eyes were blue.
I didn't know your eyes were blue.
So yeah. We are doing workshops here, and you're going national. We didn't get to talk about how you're taking this from couples to cities. And how relationships are, if you heal one relationship and you spread it out, like this is the way to cure our social ills that we didn't get a chance to talk about it. Will you guys come back?
Sure, we'd love to.
Carol, you're doing stuff here in the city. You are the ambassador here in New York City. What are you doing? Tell us.
Now I'm doing a training, but I am going to be doing a training at Cape Cod this summer that I'd love to invite therapists to join me in July 2nd to 6th. And I'm doing a workshop at the Positive Mind on June 9th and 10th for couples, the Getting the Love You Want workshop.
That's for one day?
Or? That's 2 days. It's a Saturday and Sunday.
What's the date again?
June 9th and 10th. And Harville and Helen are doing a workshop at Omega Institute that same weekend, June 9th and 10th. So they have a choice of coming into the city or going out into the country.
This is really rich stuff. Thank you both for all three of you for being too rich. I mean, we have more shows to do. Harville Hendricks, Helen LaKelly Hunt, Carol Kramer, thank you all for being here. We look forward to having you back.
Thank you for having us.
Our pleasure.
It was
quite welcome.
It was really fun.
Thank you.
Have a good day.